a review of the review. I thought it was helpful to actually schematize the whole book, so I thought, let's just spend about 5 minutes. This contains the whole book. And when I was reflecting on our review last time, I realized this book is really like a drama, you know. It builds up, there's a high point, and then it builds down. Now we're at the building down stage. So I just tried to diagram this. It may help you to just visualize the text as a whole. I think in a text this complicated, the danger is always that you lose the forest or the trees. So the first three parables were his being overwhelmed by the experience. The first was he was depressed, the black cloud. The second was images of flooding. And the third was the image of the prison, the first three parables. And that prison was the meaning of the experience was unavailable to him, which is the same as being overwhelmed. In the fourth parable, we began to see he got clarity. And he got it, however, by forcing the experience into a paradigm which he recognized. He essentially said, look how this confirms my understanding of the Holy Spirit. This is an experience of the Holy Spirit, which Jung wouldn't necessarily disagree with, that it is an experience of the Holy Spirit. But Jung and von Franz, at least, felt that the import of the experience was to show him a different understanding of the Spirit. Anyway, he truncates the breadth of the experience and, however, gains stability. The key image, I think, in the whole book is that one we talked about in Parable 5, where there was a house, and inside the house was the light of the union of the sun and moon. Remember, we contrasted antiquity as being the light of the sun and moon. We called Christianity the light of the Lamb. And we're calling this a third representation of understanding, light representing understanding. That is, it is not the light of the sun and the moon. It is not the light of the Lamb. It is the light from the union of the sun and the moon. And so that the whole point of the text, you could say, was to show him a evolving picture of religious understanding. We've talked at great length about what that means, that the sun and the moon are united. I don't think I'll repeat that. Then the neat image after that was that there was blood being poured on a rock.
You have the numbering wrong.
No, I don't. Five should be five.
But then why do you have five up on top?
Because there's two fives.
There's two fives?
Mm-hmm. They're all the fifth parable. The fifth parable contains the high point, and then it immediately begins to deal with how am I going to make that high point real. And we talked about that as the unio corporalis. It's not exactly the right word, but you know, with things like this that are so complicated, I think it's okay to give yourself little buzzwords. You could call this the phase of integration. It's not quite right. But the idea is that insight has to be made real and has to come back to the very experience it was extracted from and revitalize that experience. So the next parable, chapter 6, was about the earth, which is the place that the insight has to come back to revitalize. And what we're talking about today is the Song of Songs, in which there is a interplay between a masculine and feminine character in the text, which is based on the interchange between the masculine and feminine character in the Song of Songs. And one of the key parallels between the two is that in the text and in the Song of Songs, the women both identify themselves as dark. And that would be that this experience is something that comes out of darkness. Again, making it very simple, but we get so many details that I think it's easy to lose the general overall. And that's what we'll be doing today, is the Song of Songs continuing. Or the seventh parable, which is based on the Song of Songs. And there's a summary of the Song of Songs back of your study guide. We talked about it a bit, but I just want to give you a quick bird's eye view of what we're doing. So that was what this is about.
I was thinking about, because that rock and all that, you know, mm-hmm. the rock, as I understand you said, is the crucified Christ, more or less, or it's symbolic of that.
The blood.
The blood is, okay, the rock is?
It's life.
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 Okay, well, I was wondering if the, okay, I was just listening to one of the tapes on
the floor.
And what, the depression, maybe the unconscious trying to get us in touch with that?
Right.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, as we'll be seeing today, we'll be following up on your question very closely. If you begin to examine the implications of the imagery in this chapter, you can read it as an attempt to evolve Christianity forward.
Yeah. Okay.
Which is exactly where we are today. And it is in many ways an offense to our traditional understanding of Christianity. I almost say if you're not offended, you don't understand it. So that's what we'll be examining. That very first, the very middle image of the light of the sun and the moon is representative of the new understanding. A new understanding of what sacred is trying to make itself known to us. It's not that there isn't such a thing as sacred, Jung would say to Nietzsche, who's claiming God is dead. But there is a sacred, but it is so different from the previous understanding of sacred that it means we are living in an apocalyptic time. Again, now I'm saying it in a little bit of an exaggerated, dramatic way, but if you go back to that woman who had the affair and she pulled the diamond out of her vagina, that would be the highest value. So the dream is saying adultery is a sacred act. Under some circumstances.
Yeah, not a transcendent sense in any specific.
Under certain circumstances, right. This is not not what your hope it is.
Oh, stop.
But under certain circumstances, everything that has been labeled sinful can at times be the vehicle for a religious experience. That's what's so difficult, and why Thomas couldn't begin to deal with it. You know, for most of us today that are here, probably this, it's strange, but it's not earth-shaking. But if you can put yourself in the medieval mind, where right was right and wrong was wrong, and then to where we still have that hangover in ourselves, then it becomes offensive. Oh, and pardon?
I said I can sure put myself in.
Yeah.
That's how I was brought up.
Sure.
This is right and this is wrong. Mm-hmm. This is black and this is white. Mm-hmm. And this is blue and this is green. Mm-hmm. No, I was just going to say the same thing. You said medieval.
Oh. Same thing.
Well, of course, in a way it's the same, but remember, you know, they kill people, these transgressions.
Yeah.
So that the threat of punishment was
and the witch burnings and so on, and the Scarlet Letter and so on, which actually play a role in Pali Streams. It was backed by such a communal and legal violence that to even entertain the thought was more than a mortal could bear, probably.
Yeah, I ran across this book called In Pursuit of Millennium by a guy, a scholar named Norman Cohn, and he sort of describes some of these millennial cults that were active in like the 11th and 12th century stuff in this period. And they, like the Beguines and the Bagars and different, and they had totally different ideas about sexuality and stuff. They didn't think there needed to be any sort of church. They're just, in general, part of this Anabaptist movement. But they sort of took literally some of the things we were just talking about, which is that, you know, the whole notion of free love, like, if we're already saved by Christ, then we're directly connected to him, we can do whatever we want. Thievery, thefts, stealing, that sort of stuff. I mean, that was all part of their, they're called mystical anarchists in the book, he calls them, that sort of thing. So here's a group that had some of these same insights like Aquinas, but they went ahead and said it literally.
Yeah. The trick is to see it as a metaphor.
Symbolic.
Symbolic. Right. And also why, you know, it's very dangerous talking like this to the wrong sort of person, particularly in therapy, because they will say, oh, well, you just said for me to go have an affair. Well, actually, no, I didn't. Some people can't make that distinction. Some people really cannot make that distinction. Remember that woman who told what to tell the woman that her husband was having an affair with, how she felt? She punched her in the mouth. She couldn't distinguish a statement and an act. And so you've got to be very careful, which is why this stuff is dangerous collectively. It can certainly be used by irresponsible people to justify any sorts of nasty stuff. Okay, hopefully that will give you a diagram you can carry around. You don't have to sleep with it, but give you just an arch of putting the whole text in perspective. Where we started, what we reached, and now what we're doing is trying to take that insight, the light of the sun and the moon, from the union of the sun and moon out, and we're trying to bring that down to earth.
So this is really an image of what's happening to religion in today, but it's also our own journey, our own individual coming back to that place that we were at first and knowing it.
Yeah. In a new way. I think you can say that this is the personal story of Thomas. It's what he needed to change. Mm-hmm. But it's also the story of what Christianity needs to change, he being a representative of the Christian paradigm and this material therefore addressing all of Christianity. It's the content, largely the content of our apocalyptic time, that things that were once deemed sinful are simply pressing for recognition. And the way an individual with the weak ego recognizes them is to live them out. That's crime, that's promiscuity, that's, you know, guys ripping off Republican campaign funds and things like that. It's also our own personal journey to see what in ourselves is looking to put us into a vessel whereby we transform.
I like the way you use the four colors.
And it's color-coded.
Well, couldn't this also work upside down? I mean, because what starts the overwhelming stuff is a sort of a descent, as it were, the Nikaya, whatever, and then eventually comes at the sun at midnight, so to speak, the bottom.
It could, yeah. Questions? You have a feeling for the whole text, at least. 365 is where we stopped. Where we left off was we heard the figure of wisdom announce herself, and then we heard the bridegroom who we said represents the earth, announce himself on 364, the second aurora quote there after the dash. And then we heard that wisdom is giving him wings like a dove. And he stands with the queen. We'll be looking at the queen later. That wings like a dove is the theme we're going to be following in many different versions and ramifications throughout the chapter. That is the spiritualization of the body. Now, what does that mean? The body, remember, we're speaking symbolically. The body and reality and emotions, I think, could all be considered synonyms here. What's the common link? It's that part of your life and your response to life in the real world as it affects you emotionally.
Can you say that?
It's about the you're living in the real world. You're living and fighting in the real world. And the way you emotionally respond to that. That's what this guy stands for. You will hear him called many different things. You'll hear him called the body. You'll hear him called emotions. You'll hear him called reality. And they're all different aspects of concrete life in time and space. When the experience hit Thomas, you know, it knocked him down. And at least this is the portrait of the process that we're seeing running in his unconscious. He got clarity, but at the expense of vitality. Vitality in daily life, paying taxes, earning money, raising children, buying houses, going to car repair shops. That's why we link vitality and reality, or emotions and reality. So a whole dimension of life, you might even say what most people call life, life in time and space, has been dampened down in the process of coming to consciousness. Because the things that you used to drive you, you now have control of. But the energy of being driven isn't available to you. You generally don't care because you're so happy to have control of yourself. But in time, you get bored. So like people in AA, after a couple of years, will start coming to somebody like myself because they have changed their behavior, but they're missing the thrill of life. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what this text is about, taking the recognition of who one is that has come through the Sophia experience. Remember, we talked about Sophia originally as the pattern of your fate. Taking that knowledge and then taking that knowledge back to life.
So bring vitality back into that.
Which brings vitality back into life, which reanimates your emotions, which makes daily life seem more interesting. But now you can do it without being driven by that. And what we're going to see is, as far as this text is concerned, is that makes what we thought was secular reality our new altar. That's part of the paradigm shift. The Mass is no longer enacted in a sanctuary. The Mass is the union of consciousness and living. That's what the text will be implying as she interprets it. So that's the final paradigm shift, or the final part of the paradigm shift. So that takes us to 365. You okay with that? Hearken, therefore, O daughter, and see and incline thy ear to my prayers. So he's speaking to wisdom now. For I have desired thy beauty with all the desire of my heart. Skip a little bit to the last couple of words. My substance is as nothing before thee. So that is physical reality, that is the emotional part of you invested in physical reality, asking to receive the change that started through insight into itself.
I don't understand.
Maybe this will help. If you can think of your daily life as a person, I think what's so difficult here is that it's asking you to think about yourself in a way you're not used to thinking about yourself. You think of yourself as an agent who does things, but this figure is the you who is doing things, and it's longing for an infusion. The way you do things can receive an infusion of illumination.
Illumination.
Right.
Okay.
The way you do things
can receive an infusion. Infusion.
Can receive what?
Infusion. A floozy. An infusion.
An infusion.
Yeah. In other words,
an infusion of what?
Illumination.
Okay.
That's where the L came from.
is that like seeing what I do that's ordinary, simple, whatever, with new eyes?
Exactly. That's a good way to put it.
Seeing it as sacred instead of like, I'll hurry up and get this done so I can do something important.
Mm-hmm. Your experience of life actually changes.
Yeah.
You do the same thing you did before, but it feels livelier, mm-hmm. more satisfying. Life receives an intensity. And again, that life that receives the intensity is here personified by the guy. He's asking her to come and ennoble him. And that's what happens when you get in touch with wisdom. The next phase of that process is that that wisdom will penetrate. Your doing self and make life more interesting.
Just below this, they talk about spirit. Are they using spirit with the definition that Jung does in the sentence of Reitzenstein right here? The very last sentence.
Yes, right. Sophia, yes, he is. Yes, he is. I believe so. Sophia is a spirit. And Sophia is an image of a certain part of the spirit.
He calls it a lower part of the soul.
Because these Sophia experiences generally come through instinctual encounters.
That makes it make
sense. And that then you comes down into your daily life and changes the way you feel about things. Your emotions get stronger. Your interest gets livelier. Your capacity for enjoyment increases. That's what wisdom does to you. That's what the text is showing. You get her, and then she starts working on you. I got an interesting little fortune cookie, which I put up on my refrigerator. It says, simplicity is the highest form of sophistication. So you could say that the effect of Sophia is that you can enjoy the simple things. You don't have to seek speed. You don't have to seek opulence. You don't have to seek power. They are all, even in the Christian frame, indications of a lack of spirit. So that's what this chapter is about. This guy representing that part of your life. I tried to give you some words for it, affecting the way you feel and live life.
Now he calls this spirit. I keep getting confused in this one paragraph here.
Yeah.
He calls this the symbolic body that we're talking about. He equates that with this spirit, with the spirit.
Where is it?
The last two sentences.
As Reitzenstein emphasizes, the spirit is, as it were, a kind of lower part of the soul, which serves the true soul as a kind of body.
Is he equating that with the body we're speaking of?
Yeah, I would take that body as the way we're speaking of it. And see, he is an alchemist? No, he's describing the spirit of in Gnostic understanding, and see they couldn't quite make the leap to the physical body, so it stays as a kind of body. We're saying it is the body.
But didn't we just equate that with the spirit in the Jungian sense?
Which?
The body.
The body receives the spirit. And moves in the way the spirit makes possible.
That's how I understood it until mm-hmm. I started reading this paragraph.
I think that's what he's saying.
Okay.
Spirit is, as it were, a kind of lower part of the soul, right? Which serves the true soul, right, as a kind of body. I would interpret that to mean, at that point, the spirit and the body are working together.
The physical body, but...
Yeah, the physical body, but remember we're speaking about that as in a broad way. Your physical existence in the world and the emotions that go along with that. And the reason they don't make it as black and white as I just made it is because they were still in antiquity. In other words, it's only now that we can really see how time and space is sacred. Time and space has not been sacred in any religion. It's the gods that are sacred. And the best they can do is approach reality. And if you think you're free of that prejudice, think of when you hear somebody say, oh, he or she is a spiritual person, that's a good thing. If you say they are a material person, that's a bad thing.
But here in Aquinas, it's still a spiritualized body. Is that right?
With Aquinas, it's still an intuition.
So thus spiritualized.
Thus not yet really understood in the manifestations that we can understand it. Which means that, you see, if you say the body is sacred and you commit adultery with that body, that means that adultery is sacred. That's why they keep hedging. They're sort of moving in that direction, but they never fully get there because the implications could not be tolerated by that moralistic consciousness of the time. Now, we'll see that Sophia does indeed have her own moralistic, I can't say moralistic, her own moral system. It's not like you're getting off. But it's a different system, and it requires a maturity to enact. It requires individual decision to enact. Where the Ten Commandments, you just follow them. There's no individual consciousness necessary. And there are many people for whom the Ten Commandments are, you're happy to get them into the Ten Commandments. I remember the dream of a sociopathic woman once that she was sitting on her porch looking at a bush. And the light was very dim. Now, that isn't immediately obvious, but if you think about the bush mythologically, burning bush, there's no fire in her bush. Who gives the fire to the bush?
Would it be the light of the sun and the moon?
Yahweh. I mean, I'm thinking just now in the Old Testament account. See, this is somebody for whom this material would be a total error.
Okay.
There was no fire in a bush. Mm-hmm. There was no Father God. And what else happened there? Ten Commandments. You see, this is a person who had never experienced the love of a father who could instill in her a value system. So, in such a case, a therapist would be happy to get the Ten Commandments into that person because life was lived in the most inconsiderate and thoughtless and hurtful way. This is about a psychological task 2,000 years later. where we're assuming the Ten Commandments are working, and the morality of Sophia looks immoral from the point of view of the Old Testament very often, but it is also moral from her point of view because it's asking for individual decision. Does that make sense? Big difference. And that's why this hedging, I feel, that he couldn't fully accept that, because think of the state of humanity in the 12th century. It was still capable of great hedonism. Not that we aren't, but there is hopefully, through the developments of the last 200 or 300 years, an increased sense of responsibility to the Western ego, at least in some parts. So that makes this stuff then something we can turn back to without getting blown away by it.
It kind of reminds me of, I think about it as the instincts at that point in time were pretty much blood dry by anybody who was connected to Christianity. In other words,
right.
All the instincts were very formulaic in terms mm-hmm. of how you were to respond to them. And it feels no different than today when a woman wakes up into her power and realizes she doesn't know what she feels. You know, you have not followed your own desire for such a long time, you don't even know what it is. So when it begins to show up in your life and you have a desire, it's really scary because it may not include your family, you know, or your friends or whatever. So, you know, I liken what they were experiencing back then when any sort of light was lit under anything instinctual.
It's very similar. There's a slight difference, I think, in that I think it's probably a risky statement, but they were closer to the heathen. That the reason they were so dry instinctually was that the opposite was so scary. Now, today, we are not quite as close to falling in danger to the heathen.
But we are the patriarchy. So I sort of liken it to that idea. Patriarchy cannot allow feelings. When you bring any sort of emotion into any sort of feeling element into it.
Well, yeah, patriarchy and Christianity be the same thing in that sense. Thomas's Christianity would be patriarchal. This is what this material is trying to change. But the other thing patriarchy has given us is ego strength. And with that ego strength, then this is not so threatening. And that's what Carol was driving at, I think, in her question. Why is it like, well, it says a kind of body. Why didn't it just say the body? Because it was still not clear at that point how the body could be an agent of the spirit without destroying somebody.
I'm not sure I would agree that patriarchy has given us ego strength. I think it's given us the conversation for it, that if you wake up into that conversation, you can participate in. But many of the women I know have no ego strength. Patriarchy has just sucked it away. The opportunity to gain it has been made available. And we're probably getting down a wrong
path. Well,
but when I was reading this, the other thing that bothered me is they kept talking about it as the lower soul. And I know that was all part of what being talked about at that time, but that's that hierarchical idea of something's lower, which indicates less than.
Well, this is from the first century AD.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway. But I bet you if I said to any woman here, you know, if you're upset with somebody, go tell them, you could go talk to them.
Well, this I don't think we sort of typify. You're saying here.
Yeah, but that's what patriarchy has given this group, the ability to distinguish between feeling and action. But my woman who punched her competition in the mouth did not have that. And I think that's what patriarchy gives us, that ability to control ourselves. It's at the detriment of the self. I don't disagree. But it's part of the whole separatio process. It's control. We are now over-controlled, so it's an offensive word. But you don't appreciate what we have until you see people who can't control themselves. Then I think you can say, okay, there has been some quality added to the ego. Okay. that, so I'm nothing before, so matter, matter uninspired is nothing. That's what it is talking about. And again, matter, life and time and space, emotions, your physical body, what you do, what that might be a good way to put it, what you do, can be reshaped by an understanding of the spirit. And when you do live that way, you have gone through this change that we're talking about. So it's the difference between pushing yourself through life and feeling that you're being carried through life.
What you do can be reshaped by an understanding of the spirit when you go through
the Sophie experience, such as he is. You go through a darkness, you have a revelation, and I think, again, the distinguishing feature here is that experience is a low, meaning bodily, instinctual experience from the earth, or from your desire, from your emotions, from your greed. Yet, you end up revitalized. It may have an immoral-looking beginning, but it doesn't have to be an immoral ending, if consciousness knows how to work with it. Saying the same thing now, that's, we've harped on this idea, but we're going to see this idea now just rephrased many times throughout the chapter, such as on page 366. 366. Third line down. She seeks her body and is united therewith and receives life and activity. And that union and composition comes about by the mediation of the spirit. And when she is joined to the body, she lives forever with her body. But this conjunction takes place at the birth and the resurrection of the soul. Same thing we just said. Body there, meaning your physical existence, your daily activity.
Oh, I thought it was getting Christianized because it says lives forever with her body. So that's like a corpus glorificatum kind of body, I thought.
Same thing, only difference is in this paradigm, that transfigured body is your revitalized life.
In our paradigm.
That what the idea of Christendom, of the transfigured Christ, means when translated into this paradigm, it means the change in the way you live. The body is transfigured. The body, meaning all those things that I put forward. Why do we keep saying the body? Well, I think because it's the physical part of our life. But also I think people physiologically change in this process. I remember when I started off in Zurich working with a woman who was going through a process like this. People would walk by her in the street and not recognize her. She physiologically changed over the period of a month. Her face changed, her gait changed. So it's the body, it's this body as body, it's this body as metaphor, both.
And while we're even taking it into with your physics, you know, we're looking at actual matter in the test tube. I mean, matter as a mystery in itself.
Matter as a synchronistic event. All of the same. Are you clear on why we're saying body? To me, that was where we might get confused. It's both a physical reality and it's a metaphor.
I guess what I'm trying to keep straight is the different writers that she speaks of and how, what their attitude is to what they're saying about the body. And I'm looking here at
each one's a little different.
Petrus Bonus, when I'm thinking,
yeah.
Well, to him, that was a glorified body.
Yeah, but always be prepared to have a broader point of view and fit all of these into it.
Right.
Yeah.
So what she's saying is that all these people had hints of this experience, and she's bringing in their reference. None of them have it exactly like we put it, because they couldn't have it like we put it. But they've got pieces of it, and we are refining it. But again, what, remember the Jungian method is we always say, are we the first person who had this thought? And she's saying, no, look at all these other people who have had precursors of this thought. Okay, 366, second paragraph. Psychologically, this process represents a further stage in integration of the self. Previously, it was concerned with freeing the anima from matter. That is, withdrawing her projection and transforming her into a function of relationship with the unconscious. That was the extraction of understanding, reached its culmination in the fifth paragraph. The self was then manifested as the King of Glory in the second Adam. That was when he refers it to the Holy Spirit into Christ. But now a new problem is constellated, the freeing of the body itself, in which the fallen Sophia was imprisoned. Saying the same thing, what this is doing is going back to that body now and enlivening it. This is the stage of the Unio Corporalis, one body.
They feel that Dorn was looking at this as an actual body, or was it still a mystical body for Dorn?
I think he would refer to the body as the physical side of the prima materia.
So it was mystical.
Yeah. According to him, the body must be distilled, and see, the body must be distilled, you could have put in there the material, until it turns into a blue liquid called heaven. Parallel narcotics being the volatilization or sublimation of the body, which is accomplished by the bride, giving it wings and clothing in its raw garment. Same thing, different language.
Okay, so is it saying then that the body, the transformation is almost like the resurrection with a new body?
It's saying it, I think it's exactly
okay.
Like.
Okay.
So that, well, when it's look, the next sentence I was okay. going to look at was 367. Correctly recognizing the spiritual one-sidedness of the Christ image, see where I am about halfway down?
Mm-hmm.
Theological speculation had begun very early to concern itself with Christ's body, that is, with his materiality, and had temporarily solved the problem with the hypothesis of the resurrected body. And what we are saying is the resurrected body is you, changed, living your true selfhood. Another way to say that, I think I've mentioned this, but maybe I could repeat it. I've worked with some folks who were self-described fallen Catholics, and they couldn't go to the Mass. Remember this? But when they started living the true path, they began dreaming of being in the Mass. And they were satisfied. So that the way they were living became the Mass. That is another way of saying what this is saying. You don't realize it until you watch the dreams. And you see then how when they carry out their duties, I don't mean paying taxes, I mean the duties to the self, they have a level of satisfaction that they had not had before. And they may have tried to find it in race cars, in sex, in booze. But they get this quiet capacity for satisfaction. That's the transfigured body.
And so so this next paragraph, after the one you were reading,
yeah,
I'd like some
not only
explanation of that. Yeah.
Not only does our text explain clear unconscious anticipation of this development, but certain symbolic allusions even go beyond it and carry the alchemical idea of God become physical, still further to include the physical man, so that each individual becomes the vessel for an incarnation of God.
Now my question is, didn't Jung say that the alchemists were alluding to that? And here she seems to be saying that it's a further idea than the alchemical idea.
I believe Jung's position is the implications of what the alchemist said were in that direction, but they didn't have the consciousness to and wouldn't have articulated it that way, because they,
so how is it a develop how is it going beyond alchemy? Because this is unconscious also, you would say.
I think going beyond alchemy in the sense of making it real in daily life.
That this text alludes to that idea.
Yeah, and that's the further development of the alchemical idea. Remember, the alchemists, they were often preachers. So they would have given you a standardized description of Christendom on Sunday, but be putzing around in the alchemical laboratory during the week and never realizing that one was in conflict with the other, because they never articulated the implications of what they were doing in the laboratory. And so Jung picked that up and just tried to understand how would that idea look like that they were playing with unconsciously if it were recognized consciously. It would mean that the individual becomes a vessel for God, not the mass. That's the big difference. See, in the mass, there's a transubstantiation. In the mass, there's a transubstantiation. The blood, the wine and the bread become the blood and the body. Mm-hmm. But what this is saying is the transubstantiation is a psychological task for every person. Where does that leave the church? You don't need it. It's not to say it won't cease to exist, but it might then become a meeting place for people who are living the Mass inside themselves. And then the church's theology will have changed. Again, you say, wow, what a crazy idea. But look how civilization has evolved over thousands of years. Maybe there's something to this in the long run. Now, we don't talk about this with therapy with people, unless they're theologians and they want to understand it. But we're dealing with people's concrete, helping people solve concrete problems. But when we examine the images of concrete, of the unconscious helping people solve concrete problems, it is filled with these sorts of implications. And this book is about those implications. A practical person could care less. A more reflective person may want to go into it. Should we have a stretch?